Well, hello everyone. We're glad you're here. And my name is Brad Rieger. I have the privilege of hosting A Basic Conversation, and joining us once again is our renowned theologian and priest, Father Jim Basic. And Father Basic, good to be here with you again.
I like working with you, Brad.
It's a mutual
You tend to keep me on target and keep me from wandering off into various ways.
But even when you wander, it's good. So feel free.
I don't know about
that. We learn things, and you spur reflection just in your wandering. So
we'll see. Keep me on track.
Okay.
That's your job.
Well, the general topic today is Jesus according to John.
Yeah.
And then the sub area of focus would be this idea of improving our personal relationships. Something very relative, right? Relevant for all of us.
Yeah, for sure, yeah.
But have we done in the past with the Gospels? Why don't you frame John's Gospel for
us? Yeah, yeah, we should do that because it's so different than the other three. Got four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, so different. Matthew, Mark, and Luke have similar words, similar ideas. You can put them side by side, compare them. In fact, Luke and Matthew borrowed from Mark. That was their main source. That's why they're the same. And John's gospel is so different. I mean, you could say it, if we only had John's gospel, we wouldn't have any parables. We wouldn't even have the institution of the Eucharist. We wouldn't have the Lord's Prayer. We wouldn't have the Sermon on the Mount. We wouldn't have a whole bunch of stuff that is not in John's gospel. So where'd we get John's gospel? Well, the theory is that it's a result of a person known as the beloved disciple. So we don't know who that is. One theory of, I often go by Father Raymond Brown. He's deceased now, but he was our best Catholic scripture scholar. And he said that, well, the beloved disciple was not Mary Magdalene, as some people say. It was not the Apostle John, as some people say. He thinks that it was a person who had was around watching Jesus, but was not a very important person. So nobody talked about him, talking about Peter and Thomas and James, the other apostles. He wasn't one of those 12 apostles, but he was an eyewitness. And he helped found a community of followers of Jesus, probably in Palestine. And they had Jews in there, they had Samaritans in there, they had Greek-speaking converts in that community. And so he became famous, not because he was well-known in the time of Jesus, but what he did after Jesus' death and resurrection. Mm-hmm. And then that community moved to other places. And out of those memories of the beloved disciple came, he started like a school of thought, a community. And he had his own followers. And it was his followers who produced the Gospel of John, probably written as late as 90. So if Mark was written about 70, Luke and Matthew written in the 80s, Jesus died in 30, so we got a time frame. Jesus died in 30. Mark writes first in the 70s. Paul wrote earlier, but of the four Gospels. And then John's probably completed around in the 90s. And then an editor came along and thought the ending should be better and added a second ending to the Gospel, probably over the year 100. So that Gospel is divided up into two main parts. One is the Book of Signs, the early part. It's structured around seven great miracles of Jesus. The first one is changing the water into wine at Cana. And then you get things like multiplying the loaves and fishes, walking on water, you know. And then in 6 and 7, number 6 in importance is the curing of a man born blind, and then finally the raising of Lazarus to life. And in John's gospel, the reason the Jewish leadership wants to kill Jesus is because he raised Lazarus to life and thus was getting power, more power than they had, and so on. And therefore, they felt when he raised that, we got to get rid of that guy. Hmm. That guy's a threat to our power. So Jesus is works signs, and John doesn't call them miracles because they're meant to be signs of the presence of the kingdom. The emphasis is not on, well, the emphasis is on they're telling us what the kingdom is like. Let's put it that way. The second part of the gospel is called the farewell discourse. It occurs at the Last Supper. Interesting, at the Last Supper, Jesus does not institute the Eucharist. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, at the Last Supper, it's a Passover meal, he takes the bread, said, this is my body, shares the cup of the covenant with them. This is the covenant in my blood. John, his whole Last Supper thing is an action, the washing of the feet. That's what the beloved disciple remembers most out of what Jesus did, the washing of the feet. And Jesus goes down, and Peter doesn't want him to wash his feet, and said no. And then Jesus said, well, you better, if you want to get in the kingdom. Peter says, yeah, good, go for it. And Jesus washes the feet and says, what I've done for you, you must do to others. Yeah. And then he goes on through the whole chapter after chapter saying, I'm going to leave, you know, my death is impending, predicting his death in a way, knowing that he's in trouble with the Jewish authorities. Oh, so we get a long story. And then part of it is, it's better if I go away. You'll be better off because I'll send you the Advocate, the Holy Spirit, the Paraclete, who will guide you, and you'll carry the Advocate within you. The Spirit will be inside of you, and wherever you go, you'll have guidance. It's better if I go away. Interesting idea in part of the farewell discourse. Yeah.
And inside, obviously, many rich stories and parables. How about the
not parables, I have to correct
you. No parables?
No parables in John's gospel.
Right, because we...
Great stories.
Great stories.
Great stories, yeah.
So the stories that resonate with you are what?
Well, there's the woman at the well. I often talk about her. I give lectures on her and so on. But one point we could carry away was her problem. Jesus is going to give her living water, and she says, you don't have a bucket. How are you going to get that water to me? And so the point of that story is you can't take religious language literally. No, it's not Jesus telling, no, it's not about a bucket. It's about the living water. That's the Holy Spirit who will be with you and guide you. And he teaches her throughout that story not to take it literally. And she's then able to recognize that he's the Messiah. And what does she do? She goes off and tells her people in her own village. She becomes an apostle, speaking the good news, becomes the founder of a church in her Samaritan village. So yeah, that's the main point of that story. A whole bunch of other ones. What other ones do you think?
How about the blind man?
Yeah.
That's a long one.
Long. Too long for me to exegete the whole. The word exegete means explain things line by line, and too long.
Can you give us a USA Today version?
There is, yeah. I got to figure out how to do that. No, here's the problem created. Jesus and his disciples see a man born blind. What do the disciples say? Why is he blind? Who sinned, him or his parents? What was the assumption in that society? Bad health came from demons, from sin. So somebody sinned, you know, and that's why this guy's blind. Who did it, him or his? And Jesus, no, you got this all wrong. That's not how it is. he has an enigmatic, this is for the glory of God. In other words, there's a larger transcendent picture here at work that maybe we don't understand, but it's not sin. And that's so important. That's a great thing to remember from John's gospel. People get sick and say, what did I do wrong? Their life isn't going well. I must have sinned. I'm guilty. Guilt sometimes helps us, but very often in my experience, guilt has not been a great motivator, really. Right. I mean, you could argue against that. Right. I mean, but I'm just saying out of my own experience, I often preferred not to make people feel guilty, but to empower people to take hold of their lives and so on. So no one sinned. And then this whole interplay with the blind man and the dynamics of the story, I like this. Through the story, long story, the blind man becomes more insightful, more understanding, getting a better picture of Jesus. And at the same time, the Pharisees get more angry and more blind. Mm. They're blinded because their power is threatened and so on. So the blind man, interesting how Jesus uses physical. He spits on the ground, makes some mud, puts it on the guy's eyes. You know, interesting way of working a miracle. And then tells him to go to this pool, Siloam, and wash. And that's when he has his sight back. And so that's another interesting way. Jesus doesn't say, be cured. He does a sign. In our Catholic tradition, we're big on that because we think God works through sacraments, through symbolic signs like washing with water, eating bread and wine, anointing with oil. No, that's the Jesus way, mm-hmm. in a sense of acting symbolically. So the blind man, and then his parents get into the picture, the blind man's parents. And so the Pharisees, he wasn't born blind. Nobody, that's impossible. Nobody can be, you know, so they're going to check this out. And the parents are reluctant to say anything. Symbolic of the idea that the Johannine community, that is the community of the beloved disciple, was thrown out of the synagogue by the chief priests and so on. So the parents won't say, well, ask him, he's old enough. They don't want to be charged. They don't want to get into trouble. That's what they're worried about. And so ask him. So I ask him, yes, I'll tell you, I don't know who this guy is, but this guy cured my blindness. And as the story goes on, then he comes, oh, he isn't just an ordinary man. He's a prophet. And eventually he comes to say he's the Son of God. So in the story, he, like the woman at the well, like most of the stories in John's Gospels, he gradually gets to a deeper, better understanding of who Jesus is. Mm. So if you're going to want a takeaway at the end, one of the takeaways is that who Jesus says, who do you say that I am? It's a lifelong process. If I think I got the final answer who Jesus is, then I'm wrong. That's how I know I'm wrong, because there is no final answer. It's a matter of a lifelong learning process. There's always more to learn, more to understand. Who do you say that I am? Might sound, have a different answer to it when you're 40 than when you're 20. Or maybe even when you're 85, you might see things you didn't see before. Yeah. You know? And then all the way along, the Pharisees are getting blinder, more angry, more upset. Hmm. And Jesus said, are you accusing us? And Jesus, yeah, you have to look at yourself now. So it's a fascinating story, yeah.
What about the story of the conversation with Thomas?
Thomas, the twin. Thomas is known as the twin, and he plays a prominent role in the Gospels. Jesus says, I'm going to prepare a place for you. And Thomas says, the twin says, you know where I'm going. He said, no, we don't know. We don't know where you're going. And Jesus said, well, I'm the resurrection and the life. So Thomas plays a role. And the story after the resurrection, so we get the story of the disciples. When Jesus is arrested, okay, the disciples all run away. All the males, females stay, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary. They stay near the cross. They're faithful, they're courageous. The men run away. And so when, and then they're terrified of the Jews and afraid they're going to get arrested and so on. And Jesus comes and appears to them, and to the 11, actually 10, because Judas committed suicide, he's gone. And Jesus appears, and he doesn't say, "Hey, where were you guys when I needed you?" You know, right. I mean, where was your fortitude? Where was your manliness? Oh, he doesn't say. He says, "Peace be with you." And so the disciples, and it's so, you can only try to imagine how liberating that is. You know, I had my worst moment. We were convinced that Jesus was the Messiah. He gets crucified. And we didn't behave well. And he goes, "Peace be with you. You don't feel guilty," or so on. You know, "We'll move forward from here." Thomas wasn't there. Thomas is not there. And so they tell him, "Well, Thomas, everything's cool, man. We got this all, we're in order, we're forgiven, we got a new life. Jesus was exactly who he said he was, the risen Lord, the Messiah." They're excited. I'm not buying it. I'm not buying it till I see him myself and put my hand in his side and my finger in the nail prints on his hand. So Jesus then comes again. And now Thomas is here. In fact, okay, he's going to play the, "Okay, Thomas, how about putting your finger in my hands here?" You know. And so Thomas then, with one of the great lines, gets the point, says, "My Lord and my God." Great line. That's my own mantra for my breathing meditation. My Lord and my God. It's a wonderful statement of faith. Mm-hmm. Thomas makes it. And what does Jesus say? "Blessed are those who have not seen, yet still believe." Hmm. Blessed. That's us. That's us. We weren't there. We weren't there 2,000 years ago. We didn't run away. We didn't witness his resurrection in that way. "Blessed are those who have not seen, and yet still believe." That's us. And so, in a sense, the story is an invitation to try to deepen our own faith and to look at in our own fortitude, trying to live the faith. I mean, you can get all kind of lessons out of it, right. You know. And it's tricky because for a lot of people, they haven't seen, but they have clear religious experiences. You know, like Mother Teresa. Jesus talked to Mother Teresa, called her to minister to the poor in Calcutta. She had absolutely no doubt about it. It was a clear experience. But she didn't feel the warmth of that experience. It didn't stay with her. Her heart was cold, and she felt that Jesus had rejected her and didn't love her anymore, didn't care for her, you know. So people who have strong religious experiences and you know, are very blessed with that. And so you say, well, they didn't see Jesus directly, but they saw him. Guy is so proud of his wife. His wife is a great person and loves the kids and is the world's best mother in the world, and she's involved in the civic community. That's Jesus for me. Right. That's how I know the power of Christ, because this woman I'm married to lives it in her everyday life. And besides that, she puts up with me. She's a saint for doing that. So, in other words, he works through the other people like that.
So why don't we spend the last part of our conversation talking about this idea of how Jesus and the Gospel of John can be instructive and how we can improve our relationships.
Yeah, you bring up, it brings to mind Pope Francis for me. I mean, there's a lot of ways you could spin off of this. I mean, one is that Jesus speaks to each one of us, calls us by name, and there's a way we could all advance in our faith. For some people, it might mean, well, I don't go to church anymore. I'm going to start going to Mass, you know. Or I got a good marriage, but it'd be a lot better if I was kinder to my wife. I'm a great mother, but I'd be a lot better mother if I listened more to my teenage daughter who drives me nuts. So that would be one way. The other way is to let it spin off into the whole question of dialogue and how we relate to one another. Pope Francis talks about creating a culture of encounter, a whole way of living where we interact with one another on the basis of respect and mutuality, where we try to serve the common good together, where we try to have genuine dialogue. So as Martin Buber, the great Jewish philosopher, taught us, dialogue means that we're searching for a truth greater than either one of us has in the beginning. So our conversations, Brad, we could say we each got our take when we start. Hopefully at the end, we've seen something that neither one of us saw to begin with. And now we both see it better than we did before. We arrive at a truth greater than each one of us possessed at the beginning. So dialogue is a growth process, a learning process, in which the big thing is to respect others. So what Pope Francis says, we're not going to get any place in our world, in our polarized political situation, in world peace, in religious dialogue, without a culture of encounter. That is a whole way of living, a whole new way of thinking, so that it's not a question of dominating one another or controlling one another or who has the most power in a relationship. That's not what it's about. It's a matter of together, working together to create a better world. I often think in second marriages, second marriages often fail at a high rate, more than first marriages. Why would that be? Well, I always put a lot of stress on power. Somebody in this relationship could have more money than the other one, Somebody's putting more into it financially than the other, And is that going to influence how the relationship works? No. And what is it you could learn from your previous marriage that you could bring to this one that would help you to make this one succeed when the other one didn't succeed? So there's a sort of learning process. But, yeah, have to dialogue, accompaniment. That's what Francis so big. That, when he deals with gay people, says, who am I to judge? But what he wants to do is walk with them. Juan Cruz from Chile, gay man. He met personally with Juan Cruz about his accusation of sex abuse against the bishop, and he learned from Juan Cruz. But he accompanied him. He walked with him. And I just wrote that to somebody who's ill. I suppose influenced by Francis. You're far away, I can't be with you, and so on, but I want to accompany you on this part of your journey. It's a wonderful idea to me, accompaniment. That's what people in second marriages and divorced, remarried, and the question is, can they go to communion or not? And what Pope Francis says, well, I want to walk with you. And your priest should walk with you. Your pastor, you talk to your pastor. Talk to your pastor and see if he should walk with you. Right. Not tell you what to do, but be present to you. I think we probably could all think of people in our lives who have walked with us.
Unconditionally.
And we appreciate that. Yeah, yeah. I mean, and that's such a blessing. And And they say, well, I didn't do anything. Yeah, you did. You were present.
Just there.
You were present there. Yeah.
Don't you find, too, that people are just ill, just being there versus the words?
Yeah.
That accompaniment, the presence.
Yeah.
Is what really matters.
Presence, yeah, it's a good word to go with it, yeah.
Let me see if we can finish this idea of Jesus being instructive on relationships. I'm taking this from your notes here on the Gospel of John. The definitive model of how we are to relate to another, Jesus.
Yeah, he's our example. As Christians, we say we want to follow Christ. We say he's the supreme teacher. He's our model for everything. That he was shared our life with. That's why it's so important to stress the humanity of Christ. You know, that he functioned in this world as a human being. He was true God and true man. He was fully human. You know, he said things like, well, I don't know when the end of the world is coming. And he had to sort of remake his ministry when certain approaches weren't working. He had to follow. So people, if he talked about himself as the Messiah, then the Jewish people wanted him to lead a political movement.
Right.
And he had to figure, well, I don't want that. You know, I'm here to spread the kingdom. So he had to find ways. So he kept quiet about the political side of it, you know. So he kept adjusting to his own ministry. And that's why we think we could follow his mouth. See, what he did good for people, those examples that you brought up earlier, he led people to a deeper faith. You know, what would it be if parents did that with their kids, you know? What would that look like? I still remember one home mass when we started talking about that. The kids were present and the parents were there. And it became clear that the way the father influenced the kids was by small ways of saying that God was important in his life. And he shared that in the dialogue homily at mass. It was so powerful, you know, that... you know, God gave me your mother and I treasure her. Or teenage son, you know, son, I would have never got through when I got fired from my job. I would have never got through. You know how I bounced back? Because God was with me. Because I believed that God was with me. Because I believe that Christ suffered and died for us. Christ was disappointed. His mother didn't understand him. The religious authorities didn't understand him. The political authorities wanted to get rid of him, you know, and he kept persevering. And when I think about it, that's how I got through that job loss. Mm-hmm. That's why I got, you know, carried on and supported you. It became interesting how often just little sayings, just, you know, little remarks to the kids made the big influence. That's what they remembered. Yeah.
Right. So looking for concrete ways to show our love to the people in our lives would be very Jesus-like.
Yeah. Right. Well, the family first, mm-hmm. right? In Catholic circles, we call the family the domestic church. The family is where we learn how to live as Christians. It's there where we learn that how to forgive people, how to fight and get over it, how life isn't simple, that there's always complex situations and people rub us the wrong way, and we can't let that get us down. We got to try to keep in mind the way people, the good things they do, and not just pin the bad. Well, my sister did this. I mean, yeah, but she also did something good. So it's a school. It's a school in Christianity. It's where we live the faith and learn how to faith. In real life, it's not theoretical. It's like, what do you do with your brother who's a better athlete than you are? 2 years older, you'll never live up. He played college ball. and I'm never going to be able to do that. How do I find my own way? You know, the life, the family, you know, is a school. Okay. School where we learn Christian values.
Well, we've learned some things here, too, in this conversation. And Father Basic, thank you for walking us through the Gospel of John and giving us some perspectives on how we can improve our relationships.
Yeah, good work. You do a good job of leading, Brad. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.